Evident Footprint Show, where we talk about government, music, art, health, science, ufology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth, and when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evident Footprints, Don Nikoloff. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com. I'm your host, Don Nikoloff, and I will be with you for the next 2 hours. And I want to welcome everyone that has joined us on this November the 7th on the West Coast, or if you're in the Eastern and Central time zones, then you already know that it is November the 8th in the early morning hours. Well, what have we on the table for tonight? Well, first I would like to let the new listeners or folks that missed last night's show and didn't have a chance to hear the archive know what we talked about last night with my special guest, Michael Anthony. I sort of did a show where there was a little bit of teaching involved. We had a discussion about how to deal with the issues, the problems that we're facing right now. I've gotten tons of email from listeners who are enjoying the show, appreciating the dialogue that's going on, even my rants or my monologues, if you want to call them that. I've been calling them rants because I have been ranting. And in an effort to awaken some folks, in an effort to, let's say, produce some actions to get the energy moving and stirred a little bit, because we've become very complacent and detached from the reality, and everyone is wondering, what can I do? People are getting the message, and I'm grateful for that. I'm very thankful for the responses that I get and the fact that people are enjoying the information that's coming out from myself and most of all from my guests. Regardless of who the guest is, I get tons of email in appreciation of the messages that come forth, the wonderful information as to how to become healthy, how to stay healthy, how to be healthy. And we will at some point do a show or many shows on prosperity, not necessarily in the financial or the economic sense, but in terms of abundance, in terms of having a fulfilled and or fulfilling and enriched or enriching life. We want to be able to transcend the past and move into the now. Everyone's worried about the future. We're thinking about the past, and we're thinking about the future, and we're missing the moment now. And when you get into a state of higher consciousness, everything becomes a now. We're going to be talking about that in a moment. So, in response to all these questions, especially the most common question, the most profound question is, what can I do, meaning the listener or the person sending the email, what can we do individually to help this issue, help awaken others? Because those of us who are listening to shows like this, and I listen to as much information from other hosts and other researchers, other authors, teachers, lecturers, people who are awakened, so that I can learn, because it's not like I know everything. Don't get that misimpression. Don't have that impression whatsoever that I know everything, because the more I learn, the more I realize I don't know. Maybe the difference between myself and some other people is that I take what I know and I put it to work in my everyday experience. And so I see the importance of bringing this message forward and sharing information and in a way that it becomes understandable and practical and something that you yourself can put to work in your own way. And it's the concepts that are important. The message that I bring forth is not about me, it's about us, and it's about our relationship to each other. And we now begin to get into the aspect that we have a reality that has been created for us with an intention, and we have beaten that issue to death in every aspect that it occurs and it exists in this false reality that we have been given here called life on planet Earth. And we all know deep down inside that we're here for other reasons than the ones that are handed to us on a silver platter every day. And we are seeking to be free and to experience ourselves in a free state, in a creative state. So what we're going to be talking about more tonight is a continuation of what we spoke about last night. Now, before I just ramble on here, I want to bring back our regular Friday night guest. He is a scientist, inventor, author, lecturer, and teacher, and he is my co-host on Evident Footprints every Friday night, Mr. Jim Murray. Jim, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Don. How are you this evening?
I'm fired up. I'm raring to go because this is very exciting for me to be able to focus on the positive end of what we can do to affect a positive change around the world and even in our little corner of the universe. And so I'm raring to go.
Well, good. It should be a very energetic show then.
Now, just for purpose of recapping what we talked about last night, Michael and I, because I want us to be on the same page. We got into the issue of how does one identify this reality? How do we identify ourselves? We came up with some definitions of the individual and the fact that an individual in its truest state, in its created state, is a whole being. It's not a fragmented entity, but it has become fragmented because of the experiences that we have on this planet, many which are designed specifically to cause us to become fragmented. So we are scattered and divided, if you would. In terms of society, we are also divided because we are made to crave things for ourselves, and then we put others second, whether it's our spouse, our children, anyone in our immediate family, our friends, our associates, on and on and on throughout our life. And in a day, if you think of everyone that you come into contact with, you get a mixture of all of those types that I just described. People we do business with, people we just happen to meet or see or get in our way, or who we may have the opportunity to help for a moment. We have all kinds of experiences, and yet we put ourselves first. Now, there's not necessarily anything wrong in that as long as we're doing that from the heart. We talked about the fact that true knowledge comes through the heart, not through the mind heart. We have this sort of a synthetic mind heart that's been created for us in this paradigm or this matrix that we're in, which is keeping us in bondage. And it's cutting off our creativity. It's cutting off our connection to the rest of the universe and ultimately to the truth. So we're operating under false laws or false pretenses. With no direction, but actually doing the bidding of someone else that has planned it to go this way for us. And we are imprisoned by that. We are not sovereign as we are created, or we're not living, we're not being the sovereign beings that we were created to be. We are humans, but we are not human beings anymore. And so our intention is to bring us out of that tonight, as well as any other show that we focus on this topic, in the sense that we allow ourselves to, again, use our imaginations and be creative, being positive, but coming to an understanding of our true purpose for being here and how we are connected with all of life. what we you and I have talked about this already, that man is on a destructive path. Mankind is destroying everything that's here. Mankind is actually being controlled by other forces and is totally oblivious to that fact, totally ignorant of that fact. And so we are going to face the truth. Now, when we, in doing so, and this is still the recap of last night, we had 2 hours to discuss this. We identified problems and simplified what a problem is just by explaining or defining that a problem is undesired results. It's something that is less than what we would choose for ourselves if we chose the highest vibration or the highest quality of anything that we experience, whether it's in the doing or the being or the feeling or the seeing or the hearing, whatever aspect of our perceptions and our consciousness we would choose would be of the highest order. So to solve a problem, we first have to admit and recognize that the problem is there, and then we also have to be serious about it. We have to be attentive about it. We can't be flippant. We can't pretend that it's not there. We cannot deny that it's there, because in doing so, we allow it to persist. And we go further in the opposite direction of what our intention would be were we to regain our sovereignty and our creative imagination and our higher gifts, our higher abilities, ultimately becoming consciousness through knowledge and ultimately seeing the truth and knowing the truth and living the truth in real time, in the eternal now, as opposed to in the past, repeating the same mistakes, going around the merry-go-round without really changing the approach or the methods that we use to get out of that revolving situation, or in the sense of communication with each other, agreeing that we must together be focused and working for the same cause, that we become better listeners, and that we honor each other's place as individuals, but that we are all part of the big one, the whole. Describing also the individual as a whole being in its truest sense, or a holy being, or a sacred being. So that's basically a synopsis of everything that we covered last night in a couple of minutes.
Well, it sounds like you had a good show.
I think so, yeah. And, it was almost 3 hours last night.
Wow, that's a long one. I remember when we used to do those three-hour stints.
Yeah, they were on the schedule, weren't they? Yeah, it was tough. Well, do you have any comments about what I just, you know, basically reviewed? I'd like your input, because tonight you and I are going to talk about super consciousness and remove some of the myths.
Well, there's an awful lot of things that come to light. Of course, I had already contemplated a lot of them because I knew what we were going to talk about. But I think the first thing we should do probably is to look at consciousness itself and define the various plateaus of that phenomenon so that we know where we stand.
Okay.
If we're going to talk about superconsciousness, then we have to address, you know, ordinary consciousness before we do that.
Yes.
So, in general, consciousness, the term consciousness, might also be likened to awareness.
Mm-hmm.
Although it's probably more than that, but for the sake of getting started, let's talk about awareness for a moment.
Sure.
Even unicellular animals, like protozoan, are aware of their environment. A change in acidity, bumping into an object, chasing after food for their immediate needs, those kinds of things they're familiar with, and it does represent a certain level of consciousness. Now, we need to know where we stand with respect to that type of phenomenon, because we also have environmental consciousness or awareness of our surroundings. But hopefully, most people transcend that and have another level of consciousness over and above that. And that second level of consciousness you might term as self-awareness. Now, there's a great deal of activity going on in the biological fields now concerning self-awareness, and they've pretty much determined that there are at least several species that demonstrate the phenomenon of awareness of self. Naturally, human beings are at the top of the list, at least I'd like to think so. And over and above that, you have elephants, which are mammals, highly developed, and appear to have self-consciousness. You have your porpoises, and the great apes, and believe it or not, even some of the members of the monkey family seem to exhibit a certain degree of self-consciousness. So what exactly is self-consciousness? Well, it's, in addition to being aware of your environment, you are aware of yourself, in the sense that you are a unique phenomenon capable of influencing your own life and capable of pondering your own existence. Now, I don't want to be unfair, but, you know, if you want to look at something that probably doesn't ponder its own existence to any great extent, you might consider something like a dairy cow. I'm not saying that they're not self-conscious. Perhaps they are, but it would appear, at least, that it's a very, very low level of that type of thing, because they just sort of stand around and chew grass all day and do whatever the herd does. Of course, there are other species that do similar things, our own included. But generally speaking, we like to assume that we are above that level. So, being generous, let's assume that most people have self-awareness, and they also have awareness of environment. So, what else is necessary, and how do you get there? You know, those are important questions. Now, you were talking about, in your introduction, you were touching upon concepts like the way we have departed from nature and the fact that the world is prepared for us. That's actually a very, very important thing, because the human being, and for that matter, all animals, are designed in such a way that they have an adaptability factor. If they didn't have that, they couldn't survive. And so, actually, the people that control this planet are fully aware of that, and they make use of it in controlling us from birth to grave. Now, the way that works is like this. If you have a rabbit who is born in a normal clutch out in a field somewhere, he's immediately exposed to all of the rigorous and numerous laws of nature the minute that he arrives. I mean, naturally, it takes a little time for him to develop to the point where he's influenced by his environment. But as soon as he is, he's automatically influenced by all the things in his entire gestalt which comprise his reality as a rabbit. Other rabbits, the grass, the fields, the open sky, the forests, various plants, and of course other creatures that are sharing the world with him. Some benign and some carnivorous who are trying to eat him. All these things immediately affect his living and mold him into the character of a successful rabbit. Now, interestingly enough, humans in many cases, actually in the modern world, I would have to say most cases, are actually denied that because they enter the world in the controlled environment of a hospital. As they develop, they're not exposed to the vast array of nature in a direct way. Generally speaking, they're raised in a town, a village, a city, which is all planned out. You've got running water in the homes, you've got electricity, you've got light, you've got temperature-controlled environment, you've got traffic in the streets, there's an entire barrage of laws which are immediately descending upon you as soon as you're aware enough to realize they're there. You've got food that appears in supermarkets. You're neither conscious of how it got there or really what's in it. You're just taught that it's good for you, eat it, pay the bill, and on and on and on and on. Now, if you really stop and think about it, talking about levels of awareness, most people don't question that type of a scenario because they're born into it.
Yes.
So from the very beginning, not only is it their experience, but they see it in commonality with their parents, their siblings, their teachers, you know, everyone around them, and it becomes their gestalt. It becomes their reality. And so in the very beginning, it's accepted as the norm. Now, that's like comparing it to the rabbit that's born in captivity in a laboratory somewhere and is prodded with needles and injected with stuff and never sees the sunlight, only exposed to fluorescent lamps, and spends his whole life living in a cage, eating these peculiar little cylindrical nuggets that they feed them. And that's its reality.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't know any better.
Yes.
So now the interesting thing is, you know, what happens when something suddenly changes? Like, for instance, if the rabbit escapes from the laboratory and suddenly winds up in the real world, and actually was to find his way into a field somewhere, it would take him quite a while to readjust. He'd be stunned. Wow, you know, I've spent 5 years in this little metal cage, and now all of a sudden there's this big place. It seems endless. And it's a very intimidating and very shocking experience to suddenly realize that the thing you have always treasured as your reality is only a finite fragment of what's really available and what's necessary to become used to if you are going to continue to survive. Now, actually, as human beings, we face the exact same challenge as the rabbit.
Yes.
Because we are in an artificial and prepared world where every aspect of our lives is essentially thought through by another individual or groups of individuals, and essentially we are directed. We have all these laws, we have all these customs, and our so-called society, and of course we have the boob tube, which is forever giving you the necessary guidance for your everyday life.
Mm-hmm.
It's difficult for a lot of people to realize that this is not normal. Simply
yes,
because
yes.
You're raised in it.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned something, Jim, if I can just interject something here, because you've tied two states of awareness together. Your first description of an awareness of the environment, and it could be a protozoa or an amoeba or let's say a fish. When often when I'm teaching metaphysics, I'll use this example. When I'm asked the question, at what stage does awareness begin? And you're using an excellent description of what an animal goes through and how it uses its innate ability to adapt to its environment. And if it's the natural environment that that animal was created to be in, then it's easier for the animal to adapt. And taken out of that environment from the beginning and put into a program, so to speak, really shocks the animal. And I use this example for, let's say, a lower state of awareness, yet where an animal can still exist. Let's imagine just for a moment that we could speak either through language or telepathically with a fish, a human being and a fish. And I ask the fish before I go into the water, how's the water today? And the fish says, what water? And then I say, yeah. Okay, you are unaware of the water. Let me help you become aware of it. And so I grab the fish and I pull it out of the water and hold it above the water so it can see it. And so it can now experience itself outside of its natural environment. And the fish says, oh, that water. Of course, you put the fish back in. You don't want the fish to die. But now the fish has a consciousness or an awareness that it can be removed from its natural environment. And, of course, it would, with the choice, it would choose to stay in the water where it can breathe. and eat and live. Now, so when you made that connection with the rabbit between the laboratory and coming out into the natural environment, it was a similar example. The whatever we're exposed to is what our reality is going to be, is what you're saying.
Yeah, well, that's pretty much true if you stop and think about it. And, of course, there are always those individuals who realize at some point in their journey, hey, there might be more to all of this. And I think once you have acknowledged self-awareness, you somehow, through a natural process, desire even a higher awareness.
Mm-hmm.
And, unfortunately, in our society, there is no graduated and directed set of experiences to lead you to that. As a matter of fact, most information regarding that is removed from the environment because the people who have created all this for us don't want you to have a higher level of consciousness. But the interesting thing about it is that the urge for that is there. And the first thing that you begin to notice is the experiences of various altered states. Now, even in the normal sequence of living, there are altered states of consciousness. Like, for instance, being half asleep and half awake. Or having certain dreams which seem so vivid and so unusual that you're not satisfied with them just being dreams. At some level you figure that there's something else. And then of course you reach usually about somewhere between 15 and 19, you're bound and determined to experiment with alcohol, and then you get into the situation of an altered consciousness due to the ingestion of various stimulants and other types of chemicals, and you find out that there's something called drunkenness, there's something called getting high, and various other things. So little by little we begin to realize, even in the normal events that we experience in our lives, that that there could be something over and above, you know, what we become comfortable with in our normal so-called environment. And then for those who are really adventurous and begin to read on the subject, it becomes even more apparent if and when you start reading about the various religious experiences that are out there, and the experiences of the various yogis and other disciplines which teach a transcendence from the everyday environment and the everyday consciousness into something else. And it's that higher consciousness that we really want to attain. The interesting thing is, it's stratified. There are different levels of it. And, of course, the ultimate level would be God consciousness. And so it should be the next challenge to identify where we want to explore in this higher consciousness spectrum, and how do you get there. Would you agree with that, Don?
Yes. In fact, last night, and I sort of counseled on this, with the disclaimer up front, and this is as a courtesy to the listening audience, that I and Jim will say the same thing. No one is asking you to believe what we're saying. On the basis of just the definition of belief, that it is an assumption that a thing is so, that it is true because you've been told that it's true, or you've been forced to accept that it's true, or you've not even been given the option to consider anything else. Beliefs are based upon information or lack of information, just enough to cause your thinking to follow a particular path, ultimately affecting your actions and your feelings and your thoughts and everything that would normally be liberated or free and operating on a much higher vibration, on a much higher scale in terms of your innate abilities and your innate power. The purpose for belief is actually to hold you back or to keep you back from who you really are, to serve the purpose of another. And so we're not asking you to believe that. We would insist that you don't believe us, but that you would consider that the answers that you're looking for are within you, and we're going to do whatever we can in the best way possible to bring you to an awareness by putting the attention on the aspects of your true nature so that you can learn to tap into that through your visual capacity or your auditory capacity or your kinesthetic dash feeling aspect of who you are. And by that means, then you are in a position to make your own choices because you have a responsibility to take care of yourself. You have a responsibility to manifest in your reality what you would choose. And you have a responsibility to everyone else who is here with you doing the same thing themselves. We've got it all backwards. We've become dependent and apathetic and despondent in many ways because we have totally given up our power to someone else, and in most cases, we don't even realize or we're not aware of who we've done that. We've given that power to. We call them our leaders. They have leaders, and they have leaders. And they do not have our best interests at heart. So with that preface, yes, I'm agreeing with you, Jim, and I'm clarifying this for the listening audience because if they investigate this and they consider what we're talking about, which is a very serious issue, it's a serious issue in that it is the key to our attaining our freedom. and tapping into our creativity and not feeling fearful about our imagination and understanding our true nature so that fear doesn't even have a chance of existing anymore. You see, we bought into the illusion. So we're going to dispel illusions and replace it with truth. And we would ask that you listen from the heart center where the truth will resonate and not from the mind heart center that has been created by this matrix, which is where the ego, the false self, operates. I don't know how else to say it, Jim, other than that.
Well, I think that's pretty accurate. The first thing that we need to do, though, is to the listeners that are interested in achieving this type of freedom have to understand that it doesn't matter what you or I say, it doesn't matter what some Swami has written in a book somewhere, none of that information makes an iota of difference until the individual in question says, I'm truly interested in doing this, and I'm not afraid to exert effort. Because, unfortunately, the lackadaisical attitude that our culture has assumed over the past 100 years or so is such that we are really used to being spoon-fed. And there are very few individuals that say, well, you know, I'd rather feed myself, and I'll eat what I darn well please. So, you know, keep your silver spoon to yourself. Most people are so used to just ingesting what's handed to them that they assume that if there's higher knowledge, that they're going to obtain it the same way. And that's absolutely wrong. First of all, the people that are in control of the herd don't want you to have it, so it's not going to be on the menu. And secondly, any form of growth in the spiritual sense that's worth pursuing is always going to have a certain level of effort associated with obtaining it. I mean, if it was free in every respect, we would consider it worthless because we measure everything by its innate value. That's what we're trained to do. So I think one of the first things that you have to do is to be willing to exert yourselves in the direction of these higher goals. And if you are, then there are various ways of getting there. But before we even address that, Don, I think there's one other thing that we should talk about, and that is, why should we even assume that there's a higher consciousness?
Well, that's a very good question.
Well, I think it's an important question, because if you don't broach that, then there's no point in trying to get to it.
Well, there would have to be a reason why so many people are unhappy with what we have. What is the cause for that unhappiness or that dissatisfaction?
Well, I think a lot of that is simply the fact that they know that there should be more, but they don't know what it is or how to get to it, and their everyday busyness prevents them, you know, from investigating in any detail in these directions. And without guidance, it's easier at the end of the day to collapse into your easy chair, flip on the news, and grab a bottle of beer.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean that even the people who are in the habit of doing that don't have an inkling that there's something more.
Yes. Last night's show, we described this reality we're in as a matrix, or as inside the box, as we often say, and yet we described it as chaos. And so what we are seeking is order. which is going to require a focus, an attention, an intention as well, a choice, and a recognition that that is the scenario. That is the reality. That is the true reality. Much like it, you know, the rabbit was made to live outside in freedom, not in a cage, in a laboratory.
Right.
So, yes.
And so, in order for a person to even be aware that there's something else to strive for, some of the more ancient information might be referenced. And I know when I was younger and I read all of the teachings of various yogis and other disciplines that are available besides the ones that I was raised in, that in itself was enough to wet my whistle and make me start to ponder just how much more there is over and above what we're immersed in, like the fish in the water.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that I found most illuminating was, you know, most people believe in a God, irrespective of what their religions are. But there's a really big gap between believing in God and understanding how we fit into the picture of this universe that's been created. For me, and I'm speaking strictly about my own beliefs now, rather than try to make a general statement, but for me, it's far too simplistic to just entertain the notion of a 7-day creation story, and that answers all my questions. I have a lot more questions that are a lot deeper than that, and so I pursued those things, and basically, where it led me was really back to the creation, but from a different direction. If you read, you know, some of the most ancient thoughts that have been put to paper about that very phenomenon, the creation of the universe, you'll find that in other cultures, it's approached from a completely different point of view than it is from, let's say, Orthodox religion's point of view. And the reason why it's interesting is because, in a lot of ways, it makes more sense in tying us into the big picture. And that's part of the reason why I went there, was to find myself, you might say, at a higher octave than the one that I was allowed to perceive in my everyday environment.
Mm-hmm.
And going to this other creation theory, what transpires is rather interesting, because you have this deity, and whatever it is, it's all alone in the universe. There is nothing else available. And this deity decides to create something. Maybe it's bored, maybe it wants to find other modes of expressing itself, whatever the motive, I don't pretend to know. But here's the question that's very, very rarely asked. What did God use to create? Now, you know, the traditional way of looking at this is kind of like the magician who waves his magic wand, and bingo, a planet appears. But if you really have a deep mind and you really question the nature of energy and mass and, you know, the fabric of three-dimensional reality and numerous other things, it's a little bit hard to swallow that. Now, again, I'm speaking from my own reference point.
Mm-hmm.
What the ancient writings go on to say, essentially, is that this deity is made of something akin to light. And what it really used for the creation of everything was itself.
Yeah, that would be the answer I would give you. Yes.
Right. And so if you have the flexibility to accept that as a possibility, then we can see that not only is everything in the universe an expression of God directly, but so are we. And once you accept that as a possibility, now you have a reason, and perhaps even a motivation, to seek an understanding of a higher consciousness, because that consciousness is another facet of you. Now, what this is like is the divinity is a huge ocean, and we as created individuals are like waves on that ocean. So we each have our own distinct characteristics. We're moving in a particular direction. We are going through various gyrations. And that gives us some degree of autonomy and some degree of individuality. But in the final analysis, we are made of water, and the entire sea is made of water. And there's the commonality. So,
yes.
Getting back to, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to raise an issue here and have you comment on it. And I'm following exactly what you're saying, and I'm hoping that listening audience is. I use the word if just for the sake of allowing anyone to make that determination for themselves. If God created everything of himself, then everything that exists is God. And
absolutely.
in our individuations of God, in our lower consciousness, we have to be a lower frequency, and ultimately it would be God's purpose or his preference, if you will, his desire to see us arise back to that level. In other words, to the experiences of life and in their totality, or life in its totality, would eventually return to God whole. And I use that definition of an individual in its truest sense as being whole or holy or sacred. What else could it be but God? So I'm affirming what you said. Would you like to comment on that at all, in that sense?
Well, no, I think I agree with you entirely, because it's just, you know, we're basically saying the same thing. The thing that's interesting, of course, is at death, we return to God both literally and probably figuratively, in the sense that the consciousness is so broadened by the absence of the body that we become aware of our godlike qualities.
Or unencumbered. Yeah.
Exactly. And whether we retain any spark of our original individuality or not has been an issue that's been discussed down through the ages, and I'm not sure it's ever been resolved. But what's interesting is that it's been proven that you don't have to die to achieve that sense of unity with the divine. And that's worth striving for here, because it's like the rabbit escaping from the cage. You would suddenly have such an entirely different experience during your life that it would be, well, it should be, let me put it that way. It should be the number one thing that we all strive for as rational thinking beings, rather than the TV and the bottle of beer.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a barrier, though, which needs to be broken through in order to achieve that type of awareness. And most people who get into this eventually realize that barrier is the ego. Now, the ego is a very necessary thing, and it's constructed to a certain extent by the mind in order to allow us to survive in the life that we are introduced to. Because it becomes very important for us in the survival mode to have a particular personality, various goals, various talents, a general understanding of what this world is all about and how we fit into it, and the necessary talents to maintain ourselves while we are here. And all of those things combined with the environment create an illusion that we perceive as our personality, as ourselves.
Yes.
And as long as we are focused on that to the exclusion of all else, then it becomes very difficult to go to the next level of consciousness and experience something greater than what we experience in our everyday lives. And so most people will tell you who have delved into this that the eradication of ego is the first thing that's necessary to allow you to glimpse higher octaves of existence.
Yes. Now, again, we talked about that last night, and I merely bring that up because I'd like to just make one statement, and that's in our pursuit or our experience, because not everyone is pursuing this. So some people are just moving through this field of predetermined outcomes, if you will, because of the programs that have been put in place for the purpose of controlling us. We are operating in ego, and we are fed a constant diet or a reinforcement of that concept, because it is known by those who are feeding us that will keep us from achieving a higher state of consciousness. So the purpose is to keep us dumbed down on a mental level and disconnected or separate from our true nature. And so I'm agreeing with what you're saying in that respect, that that this ego has been created in the mind, and I'm not necessarily saying the brain, I'm saying the awareness that we're allowed to express, or that we're required to express, to carry out the duties to be a good little ant or worker bee in the system, which is not God's intention. God didn't intend for us to be those cows in the field. If he did, he would have made us to be cows, would he not?
Exactly.
Okay, so in essence, now you're identifying, we did this last night, so it bears repeating here. In the concept of where you're going with this, I'm allowing you to do more of the teaching. I'm just reiterating some of what came out last night. Because that is the false self, or that is the veil, the ego, and the belief that they've created that that is who we are, or that the belief that they've caused us to accept as the only possibility as who we are. And it isn't it interesting that whoever approaches what you have just described, going outside that and exploring beyond the ego, those people are either attacked or they're shunned by society, or their message is basically debunked in some sense. It's either ignored or debunked for the purpose of maintaining this program.
Well, that's because of the fact that the ego structure requires constant feedback in order to maintain its own illusion.
Mm-hmm.
And so everything is designed here to impress upon you that you are who you think you are rather than who you really are. Now, the real question isn't that so much. I know from my everyday interactions in the world, Don, that lots of people have thought this through to that level on their own. Where they have a problem is, okay, fine, there's something beyond all this, but what do I have to do to get to it? And that's
yes.
what's seriously missing. Now, even if you had a formula that told them exactly what to do, I'm sure that you'd find that there'd be immediately two categories, those who would pursue it and those who would just say, it's nonsense. So, from here on in, we'll be addressing those people who are looking to transcend their normal limitations and find satisfaction in knowing that there's more to life than what meets the eye.
Now, can we agree, Jim, can we agree that knowledge and its proper, in its proper perspective in relation to time in its proper perspective or the absence of time is key? In other words, when we say, well, I already know this, I learned that, this is known, we are actually identifying with the past. And so the I, or the ego, is holding on to the past. And in the state of being, we are knowing, you see, that which free, liberates us immediately, or it frees us from the past, as soon as we make that statement and acknowledge that. But it has to become an awareness, a consciousness, and it requires a focused attention. Can we agree on that, or?
No, absolutely, we can agree on that. The real thing now is to take the next step, which is a difficult one, and that is people have to realize that there's more to themselves than meets the eye. Now, there's a lot of ways that this can begin to happen. First of all, let me just regress a little bit and say that we already know from our own science investigations, and we've talked about this on other shows, Don, that there's a left and a right brain, and that the logical brain is the one that's tied in with the ego more so than anything else, because it's the thing we use in most of the solutions to everyday problems, you know, paying bills, doing our job, seeing to the family, all of these types of things. And, of course, in the process of doing all that, you constantly reinforce the fact that you are Don Nikoloff, Jim Murray, you know, John Q. Citizen, whoever. And that forms a loop that is difficult to get out of. But simultaneously, we also have the intuitive side of our nature, which is controlled by the creative part of the brain. And that's already tied in to higher informational centers, because it's the bridging of the difference between the left and right brains that starts to make us aware of higher octaves of existence.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the simplest ways to start to do this, you see, unfortunately, the way we're forced to live, the right side of the brain in many, many cases becomes either partially or maybe even totally atrophied because of no use, lack of use. And so these other features that we're talking about, which tie us directly to these higher levels of consciousness, become ignored for so many years that those channels just dry up. Now, if you want to get that going again, you have to start using it. Now, how many times have we heard stories about little children saying, "Oh, I can see fairies," or "I can see ghosts," or you know, whatever.
Auras. yeah.
And what happened? Yeah, auras. That's a perfectly good choice. What's the normal response? Oh, don't be ridiculous. You don't see anything of the sort. And so after they're chastised enough, those centers begin to shut down because it becomes a matter of survival for the child. And what I mean by that is if he insists on holding on to that facet of his reality. He or she is obviously going to remain in the displeasure of his parents. And he knows that the parents are the ones who are caring for him, feeding him, sheltering him, educating him, etc. So after a time where there's enough chastisement, those channels begin to shut down. And by the time you're 40...
And punishment and deprivation. Let's throw that in there, too.
All of the above, that stuff begins to shut down. Now, of course, there are some individuals, just by statistics alone, who hold on to a good portion of that. They simply modify their behavior, and they no longer tell their parents what they see or what they experience. And, you know, those are the people that later on in life we say, my God, you're intuitive, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the area of difficulty that first has to be attacked. And one of the best ways to do this, and frankly, this you can, when I was a kid, I used to go over to New York. There were bookstores over there that that sold all these books about Raja Yoga, spiritual development, and all this kind of stuff. And I would pick out books that had exercises in them, you know, that actually allowed you to develop these facilities. And I would buy those books, you know, and take them home and study them, and I'd sit alone and try all this stuff. And so maybe I was always an unusual kid, but the point is, at least I was trying to do these things. And most of my friends accepted my habits as odd, never bothered to do any of it, which is very interesting. So certain individuals are going to gravitate towards this stuff, and they're going to have the gumption to pursue it. And others are just going to be happy being half awake, which is what you are if you're only using half your brain. But anyway, to make a long story short, one of the best ways to start to reanimate the sleeping portion of your higher brain functions is through the development of your intuition. And I can't stress how important this is. Now, there's things that we've all experienced where we realize that we still have this facility, but we just don't do anything about it. How many times have we just known that the phone was going to ring? How many times have we said, oh, I bet you it's 3 o'clock already, and you look at your watch and it's exactly 3 o'clock or almost 3 o'clock? Those are actually examples of the higher powers of the mind being at work. Because as you pointed out, Don, that's knowing, which is a whole different thing from remembering or from learning or from any of the other experiences that we have, which require an attachment to this realm.
Or believing.
But knowing,
yes, yes.
Yeah, but true knowing transcends time.
Mm-hmm.
It's always there. It's like a continuation of the present, regardless of when you tap into it. It's always the now, and that's the reason why you know.
You know, Jim, your statement about the parents and how they respond to the comments that a child would make about what they see or what they hear, what they're perceiving through their senses, in a metaphysical sense, and how that is suppressed, is probably the single most responsible cause, let's say, or reason behind the communication problems that people have in interacting where they are engaged in a conversation, just like we are right now. Imagine if I said, well, There are things to know beyond what they're taught in school, and it starts an argument. with the person that you're telling this to. Well, don't tell me that, because that, if that, that were so, they would be teaching it in school. You're crazy. You see, the person now defends what you're saying, even though they've had that experience as a child expressing that type of information, but because they met disapproval, or they were, like you said, they were chastised about it, or maybe punished, or derided in some sense that made them feel less than who they were. They felt, I don't want to go there, so I'm not going to give that any attention. And now that sets up a block for communication later on, not just through speech or, listening skills. A part of the listening skills are the willingness to accept the possibility that the information may be true. You see, it's been sabotaged at an early age. So we're trying also to break through that veil, or that brick wall that's been constructed there.
And that's a very, very difficult course of action, because as Reich pointed out in his life's work, once you are armored in that direction, you, as illogical as it may seem, you will protect the armoring at all costs. And the reason for that, apparently, is because there's an investment of pain. There's an investment of discomfort that is so huge in getting you to that place where you are now, that you have literally molded your life around those circumstances so that you could survive. And now you've reached a point where it's actually less painful to continue in this present set of circumstances than it would be to shed that armoring and go through a new set of pains and discomfort and possibly even various forms of terror on an emotional level to obtain a different perspective.
That's where we get... Go ahead.
Most people are not willing to do that. As a matter of fact, in psychoanalysis, that very mechanism is known as resistance. And in order to find out why you like to burn other people's houses down, or whatever your problem is, you have to penetrate through that resistance. And the mind is so clever that even if the analyst already knows what your problem is, he can't just tell you, oh, you have such and such a neurosis, and this is the reason why you're doing this. His job is to bring you to a consciousness, a conscious acceptance or a conscious understanding of why you're doing it. And when you come to that realization on your own through his guidance, that's when you're cured. But the irony of it is, even though you may spend years going to the shrink at an ungodly cost, I might add, you also are going to resist ever cooperating with the guy to that point, because there's a part of you that doesn't want to know why you're doing these things, whatever they are. And that's just another extension of what Reich was trying to teach.
Yes.
So breaking through that is one of your first challenges.
Yeah, and of course, this whole condition you're describing could be reduced to one word today. You see this all over society, and that's the word denial. The fact that the person is actually willing to go through some discomfort, which often produces the glazed eyes or the flushed face, or maybe heart palpitations or heavier breathing or perspiration or any of these things, they're willing to go through that rather than face the pain and do away with it all for the sake of preserving the ego.
Oh, absolutely. Your armoring becomes a part of your ego manifestation. And that's the reason why dissecting it out of there is a painful ordeal, because you are perceiving it as an attack on your persona.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes it very difficult. But here's the good news. You don't have to start into this procedure at such an uncomfortable level. You can start at a very low level, just doing things that you can basically direct the progress by yourself and not rely on anyone else, not have to go through the embarrassment and the expense of the assistance of a shrink or anybody else. You can basically reprogram yourself if you're willing to put in the time. But you have to start small, and that's the trick.
Yeah.
Now, you've had on your show at least a couple of times my dear friend Randy Weitzheimer.
Yes.
And Randy, of course, is a past master at a lot of this stuff. And the method that he uses in his cures and in reading a person's energy level and deciphering what's wrong with him from a physiological point of view, all derives from his mastery of his intuitive side. And one of the things that he talks about as really being a stepping stone into mastery of this part of yourself is the development of your intuitive forces.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when I was a kid, I actually took the time to do this, and anybody can do it if they want to be persistent about it. You pick a thing that's easy to do and easy to verify, because the verification is what gives you the necessary feedback to start building trust in this mechanism. And once you start to use it and build trust in it, it's like a muscle. It gets stronger and stronger, and eventually it will open up into something much more than what you believe it's capable of, especially when you're starting out.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the easiest things to do, actually, is to just tell yourself the time. Don't look at your wristwatch. Just tell yourself the time. In the beginning, you're going to be all over the map. But as you persist in this, you'll find that, let's say you say, oh, it's 3:45. Don't think about it. That's where the errors come in. You have this tendency to, you ask yourself what time it is, and some number will pop into your head. And then instead of acting on that number, what we do is the rational part of the brain immediately steps in and goes, well, wait a minute, it can't be that late already. I just made a phone call 15 or 20 minutes ago, and therefore it shouldn't be 3:45. It should only be, 2:15 or whatever. And so you modify the intuitive answer, and you wind up with an error. You have to learn to keep your thinking part of your mind out of it. So if you ask yourself what time it is, and all of a sudden you get this 3:45 thing, don't challenge it, just accept it. Then verify and look at your watch. Now, in the beginning, you may find that you're 15 or 20 minutes off, but if you start doing this religiously, then pretty soon you'll know what time it is. Now, the thing about doing that is, it sounds ridiculous, but it's very important because you're using another part of your brain and your mind, which has the functionality of leading you to these higher levels of consciousness, of leading you to the knowing part of yourself. And if you want to get in that doorway, you have to start small. You can't go out and do some fantastic thing right off the bat. Remember that the gurus who spend their entire lives pursuing this stuff, they do it all day long, every day, for a century or so before they reach a level that they figure is worth their effort. So you're not going anywhere quickly in this. But in order to get started, you have to start small. Wouldn't you agree, Don?
Yes. In fact, speaking of time, we have to take a break right now. So when we come back, we'll continue this discussion. You're listening to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com, and we'll be back with our special guest, Mr. Jim Murray. Don't go away.
HempUSA.org is now offering free shipping worldwide to better serve our customers. Our goal is to get these fine hemp products to you in the least amount of time so you can enjoy what the powder seeds and oil can do for you. HempUSA.org has a warning that the U.S. food supplies are dangerously low, and we urge you to protect your family with hemp storable foods today. Tomorrow may be too late. Call 908-691-2608 or visit HempUSA.org. This incredible food source is loaded with enzymes so your body can digest the food you eat, and it creates an alkaline environment where cancer can't grow and parasites cannot live, and brings funguses, viruses, and bacterial levels down and to a halt. Try our powder seeds and oil today. Call 908-691-2608 or visit HempUSA.org. If the body has the proper nutrition, it will heal itself. Ask yourself, why does our government not allow this crop to grow in the U.S.? This product is also great for pets and animals. Call 908-691-2608 or go to HempUSA.org today.
The Idaho Observer, a monthly 24-page newspaper in its ninth year of addressing issues that affect all freedom-loving Americans, is one of the few remaining newspapers courageous enough to print the truth. Concerned about the burgeoning national debt and the Orwellian police state growing up around you? Subscribe today. Only $25 for 12 monthly issues, the Idaho Observer prints what you need to know to be a fully informed American. Go to idaho-observer.com or call 208-255-2307.
Welcome back to this second segment of Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com and our special guest, Mr. Jim Murray. Jim, welcome back to the show. I always hate to interrupt your flow there, but sometimes we do have to acknowledge time in this matrix that we're in here.
No problem, Don. No problem. I understand. But just to reiterate, if you don't mind, you know, we were just getting up to various exercises and ways in which the intuitive side of the human mind or brain can be reanimated. And we were talking about using the intuition to tell you the time. Well, that can be boring, you know, but it's something you can do on your own, you know, no matter where you are. Anytime you want to know what time it is, ask yourself before you look at your watch. And you'll find that you start to get more and more accurate.
Mm-hmm.
It is a trivial thing, and it can be boring, but there's a lot more that we can do with that side of the brain too, Don.
Yes, I agree with you wholeheartedly. In fact, a phenomenon that a lot of people are describing right now is that they'll be doing some mundane task or maybe working or just nothing important, and they'll glance up at the clock, and especially they notice this if they have a digital clock, they'll see a sequence of numbers. I do this all the time. I'll look at the clock and I'll see 11:11 or 12:12 or 3:33, or I'll see a series of numbers like 1, 2, 3 or 2, 3, 4 or 4, 5, 6. And because of the limitations of hours and minutes within an hour, you don't see other combinations of numbers, but I will tend to see that. Now, there's a message going on there with the higher self. There's a recognition that really is beginning to transcend out of time into another dimension. And you're seeing that the person that's perceiving that on the clock, seeing that on the clock, is actually experiencing that. And that is, it does have numerical meaning behind it. I'm sure you're aware of that phenomenon. You probably have experienced it yourself.
I've experienced things like that. You know, the interesting thing is you don't always know what these things mean. But when they start to happen, the key thing is to realize that something is changing and not to worry about it, because it's a natural developmental sign that something is occurring, and you shouldn't be afraid of it. That's another thing that happens, you know. People will have these other perceptions, which obviously require the cooperation of the higher side of their brain, and then they'll become afraid of it, because there's a certain amount of anxiety associated with changing yourself or accepting that you can do these things. My mother was like that. She used to have a lot of perceptions, and then she'd be afraid of them. She'd say, well, that's witchcraft, or that's something that can lead to evil. Well, you know, if you have to have enough faith in your own design to realize that if these things are happening, they're not intrinsically evil. They're just different, and you shouldn't be afraid of them. I mean, if you have fears in that direction, it's going to hamper your ability to make the transition that you're trying to find.
Wouldn't you say we tend to fear what we don't understand? In other words, where there is a lack of knowledge, there's room for the fear. And since we have been programmed so well to respond to the fear stimuli, that we're just reinforcing that ourselves.
Well, sure, you're absolutely correct. But, I mean, the reason I brought it up was because if you allow the fear aspect to master you, then you're not going anywhere in this direction. You have to remain the master.
Yes.
And that's an important thing.
I wanted to just make a comment on time now, because you mentioned something that I happened to be studying earlier this evening, about time and about the fourth dimension and some of the artistic impersonations impressions that, let's say, like Salvador Dali had done. He had created a four-dimensional cross and had Christ, the crucifix, translated into a fourth-dimensional cross, symbolic of Christ transcending time. And it's really, I don't know if you've seen that painting, but...
I've definitely seen it. I know exactly what you're referring to. As a matter of fact, I'm looking at it right now in my mind's eye. I know what you're talking.
Okay. Would you like to comment on that aspect of awareness or consciousness at this point, moment, or is that jumping ahead too far?
No, I don't mind doing that. I just don't want to lose the thought that I had, because I really was about to introduce something important, but I think I'll be able to jump back to it. The whole time thing is very interesting. First of all, you have to understand that time doesn't exist in the first place. It's actually an implicit function, the nature of which is dependent upon other things. And so when we buy into time, we marry our ego structure to the flow of a quasi-imaginary function or river or whatever you want to call this phenomenon of time. And it has the ability to affect us if you buy into it. The interesting thing about it is that there's a lot of exercises that I'm aware of where you can decouple from time. And all of this gets back to these higher functions. But in keeping with the answer to your question, Don, one of the things that's really amazing about time is its relationship to energy. And I don't want to get off on a big tangent here, but I'm gonna touch upon this simply because of the fact that not only did you bring it up, but it is relevant. We hear no end in the world today to comments relating to the subject of energy. Energy this and energy that, and, you know, it just goes on and on and on. The irony of it is, energy doesn't exist in our world in a real sense. And I don't want to get into this because it's a very, you know, long-winded thing that needs copious explanations and defenses. But the point is that if you look at energy as a mathematical, from the mathematical point of view, which makes it easier to understand, it is essentially a snapshot of some type of power function. And so it doesn't really exist in the temporal world, whereas power does. Power is a real and continuous phenomenon that has an effect in our world. So it's really very interesting that the people that are in control of everything insist upon focusing on energy, which cannot exist here in its true sense, rather than power, which is natural to the temporal world. So what I'm getting at is, when you hear the spiritualists talking about the energies that guide us, the energies that affect our lives, the energy that does this or that, the energy associated with such and such a chakra, all these various things, those types of people are not usually well acquainted with physics. And so what they're actually describing is that realm in which energy can really exist and how it affects our higher selves. And in that dimension, there is no time. And this is one of the reasons why you have clashes all the time between the scientific community and those people with a spiritual bent to them, is because the things that they say are not clarified for proper evaluation on this plane. They just speak the truth as they see it. But they don't realize on a conscious level that what they're experiencing or what they're sensing is something in a domain different from this one. And when you bring the information over, it needs to be modified so that it can find acceptance here.
Yes.
And that's something which is not usually done. And as a result, there's an enormous disparity between the information brought over by mediums and sensitives and that which can actually have a fruitful response in the world as we know it.
Well, and the scientific community, in a sense, is just as guilty of doing the opposite from their perspective, as if all of that possibility is nothing but hogwash. So, you know, and that's a sort of arrogance, maybe intentional, or maybe it's the ego defending itself.
Oh, I can assure you it's most probably the ego, because I've spent a lot of fruitless hours going round and round with people in the scientific community over the kind of work that I've spent my life doing. And the interesting thing about it is it isn't really spiritual, even though it has its origins in the higher planes. It's somewhere in between what you might call spiritual and physical, in the sense that it's waiting to be born type of stuff. But they still can't accept it simply because it's outside of their paradigm. But the whole point of making the comment was simply to verify the fact that time and the flow of time has an enormous effect, not only on us as individuals, because we're riding on the stream of time, but also because the higher self plugs into the now, which is devoid of time. And then when you bring information here, you have to have enough prudence, especially if it's important information, to know how to modify it so that it will find acceptance in our world.
Well, and not that I want to dwell on this tangent anymore, but it brings up another issue where I think there is a way between science and metaphysics to show an example where the two can coexist and be explained scientifically or let's say mathematically. The nature of a triangle, is accepted that when you have a triangle, all the angles, all the measurements of the three angles add up to 180 degrees. Is that not correct?
Yes, sir. That's correct.
Okay. Now, when you take that same triangle and superimpose it over a sphere and allow the sides of the triangle to bend to adapt to that sphere, in other words, maintain the same curvature of that sphere, you now enable that triangle to include 270 degrees.
Of course.
Okay, so in that example, that's a place where the laws of physics in the normal sense, in the accepted sense, in the 3D reality, actually enter into the domain of the fourth dimension, which would account for the speed of flying saucers, for example, and how they can defy the laws of physics in the earthly sense, in the three-dimensional sense. Would that be true?
Yeah, I mean, that's a very good example. It also exemplifies the difference between, you know, spherical trigonometry and plane trigonometry. The triangle takes on these unusual properties because, in fact, it is the intersection, or the loci, of three great circles drawn upon the sphere of the Earth. And so the area that's in the triangle, if you really examine it, can't possibly behave the same way as the triangle drawn on a flat surface. But that might be a little hard for people to grasp. I'll give you one that's even easier. If you sit in the middle of a room and you stare at the corner, let's say up toward the ceiling, where one wall is intersecting the other wall and the ceiling, you will see three lines coming together, three mutually perpendicular axes, which define the three types of dimensions in that room. Now, the interesting thing is, if you position yourself exactly at the right angle so that you're staring into the vertex of this three-dimensional junction from the right position and you continue to look at it and meditate on it, you will suddenly realize that what you're looking at is also a triangle, a pyramid, a three-sided pyramid that is separated by 120 degrees.
Mm-hmm.
So now, this is a very intriguing thing because, you know, your mind is capable of jumping back and forth between this dimension and another one. And that's the reason why you can see both possibilities if you look at it that way.
Yes.
And this, of course, brings us to the interesting point. What is necessary to literally make these transitions from one reality to another brings us right back to consciousness. If you're staring at that vertex in your room and you suddenly become conscious of the fact that, well, wait a minute, that's also a three-sided pyramid separated by 120 degrees, your mind has just made a quantum jump. And so you become conscious of another octave of reality associated with that phenomenon. Yet if you go over there and touch it and measure it, it's going to show you that it's composed of three flat surfaces intersecting at 90 degrees. So what allows you to make that transition is a higher mind function. So these are all different things that you can try on your own. But Don, if it's okay to return now, before I forget, I would like to jump back to talking about what people can actually do to open these doors.
Okay.
Because it's pretty important stuff, and it's not that difficult to do. Now, we already talked a couple of times about the importance of using the intuitive faculty to determine the time and then verify it with your wristwatch. That's one way of starting out. But it is kind of mundane and boring. What's more interesting is to start to use the same facility in a more complex way. And before I get into the actual methods of doing that, let me just touch for a moment on something which I'm sure you're familiar with. And it's called, for goodness sake, it just went out of my head. I'm going to have to rely on you to help me. What do you call the muscle testing that they use in various health disciplines to determine if something is good for you or not?
Kinesiology is one aspect of that. That's the feeling. They'll test your reflexes to measure electrical responses between the various sinews, ligaments and cartilage, and the muscle mass or the muscle flexibility.
Well, I'm talking about the one in which the muscles actually lose strength or gain strength. I think it's called kinesiology also.
Yes.
But basically the way it works is, let's say you're trying to find out if you have a problem with sugar, with unnatural sweeteners, some of these sugar substitutes, for instance.
Rat poison, you mean?
Yes. So you take an envelope of that and hold it against your chest with your left hand, let's say, and you extend your right arm, and then you have somebody grab you by the wrist and just gently push down on your arm. And if you have no strength to resist, that's your body telling you that this stuff is no good for you. And you can calibrate this by the degree of reaction that you get, starting with not having anything in your hand and resisting your friend's pushing down on your arm, so that he gets a feel for your strength also. And then when you pick up this artificial sugar and hold it against your chest, and almost everybody reacts negatively to that, Have the guy who's helping you inflict the same amount of force against your arm, and he will notice an enormous reduction in the resistive force. That tells you that the body doesn't like it. Now, you know, people say, ah, hogwash. You know, that's a lot of hooey. But in reality, if you stop and think of it, it's a perfect example of what we're talking about. Because there's a higher part of you that knows what your body needs, even if you don't. And it's been verified that this system works.
Mm-hmm.
Now, and what's interesting about it is you don't have to use it just for that. You can start to construct a whole series of feedback mechanisms or feedback loops using the higher consciousness and using this kinesiology mechanism to determine how to improve your life, for instance, or how to achieve a goal. Usually you have to do it with simple yes or no type things because it behaves a lot better as a digital system than an analog one.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have somebody helping you who is just as interested in seeing you develop as you are, that makes a big difference rather than having somebody who's very negative on the idea because that affects the outcome of the experiments. But like,
yeah.
For instance, you can take a small tab of paper and write on it a question that you would like to see a yes or no answer to. And you already predetermined, for instance, that if your arm remains strong, that's a yes. And if your arm loses strength, that's a no. Then you take and hold that paper to your chest and have your assistant, which incidentally, the wife is the best person to solicit for this, because if you develop these things in concert with one another, it will facilitate the development on both your behalfs.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, whoever you choose then applies the force to your arm, and you get your body actually gives you the answer. Well, of course, it isn't really your body that's doing that; it's the higher mind.
Mm-hmm.
Controlling the response, because this is a way that it can communicate with you. Now, I mentioned my friend Randy earlier. He started out with all this kind of stuff when he was like 18 or 17 years old, because he had already these facilities at his disposal coming from an Indian heritage. Those aspects of his life were not denied. He was not punished for having those sensitivities, and therefore he retained them.
Mm-hmm.
But later on, when he was older, he decided, well, how does this fit into the general scheme of things? So he started to try and relate this to the physical world, and kinesiology was one of the ways he started to do this. But interestingly enough, he has now matured to the point where he doesn't need anybody doing this thing with his arm. He's gotten to the point where he's replaced that mechanism by a counting procedure. And I've been trying to do this myself. It's not so easy. So that's the reason why I don't expect people to start with that. But basically, what he'll do is he'll ask a question that can have a yes or no answer, and then he'll just start to count. And when he feels a certain way about a number, then that number relates to the answer to his question. So not only is he getting a yes or no, but he's also getting a graduated answer.
Yes, that's very similar to the technique I use in dowsing, although I can arrive at the same conclusion in another way. I mean, it's a very high frequency, you know, and it comes through telepathically or through clairaudience or clairvoyance. And so, I understand exactly that principle. In fact, I sense that when Randy's on the show and we talk about those things, he sends me the telepathic answer as he's explaining that procedure that you just explained, in fact.
Right.
Yeah. Now, I have two cousins who are naturopathic chiropractors, and they have actually focused the majority of their work on various types of healing modalities that are really extensions of their discipline in chiropractic methods, and yet most of the methods have nothing to do with what a chiropractor learns in traditional medicine. It's amazing. They can touch your arm and they can tell you what you're eating too much of. I mean, that's extremely empathic there, that they can feel that. And I've seen it demonstrated time and again. Now, I have that ability also, but it manifests itself in different ways, too. I can see it before I have to go to that physical level, if you know what I mean. It's just a different frequency. And they're all really interacting with each other all the time. It's a question of whether one can tune into it or not and sort it out. Sometimes they all are firing at the same time, if you know what I mean.
Sure.
It's like picking up multiple radio stations from the same tower.
Yeah, so. That would be referred to as single sideband transmission, just for your information.
Okay. Yeah, I was simplifying it for myself, not for the listening audience. Go ahead.
Listen, I'm allowed to jab you once in a while.
You did a good job at it too. No, that's great.
Hey, the thing that's interesting about this too, and this shows you how the aspect of culture fits into all of this. As you know, I've been to Japan several times now in the past few years as guests of various people over there. And it's a really remarkable culture, and our Japanese friends are pretty unique in the way they perceive the world.
Mm-hmm.
The gentleman that was kind enough to invite me over is a very deep thinker, and we experience some really interesting things in our personal exchanges. And one of the things that I find the most fascinating is... And also, by the way, Japanese women are very sensitive in this regard, especially when you compare them to their American counterparts. We would have the tendency, I'll give you an example how this evolved. We have the tendency to, you're sitting at home with your wife, and you can tell that something isn't quite right about her mood or whatever. So your normal tendency, at least in this country, is to say, honey, what's bothering you? And you expect her to tell you something, because that's how we verbalize. You know, so then she might answer you, she might not, depending on the severity of the situation. But the point is that you attempt to solicit information by a verbal stimulus. Now, the thing that's interesting about our Japanese friends is that they're much more sensitive about these types of things, and they don't resort so much to the spoken word. And this is one of the reasons why I think there's a lot of problems sometimes in dealing with the Japanese people, and perhaps Chinese too, but I don't know because I never have been to China, because their cultural nature is such that it puts their intuitive portion of their mind more up front than our culture does. So like in the same situation where, let's say, we're in a Japanese home and you have a Japanese woman and a Japanese man, living together, and instead of him saying, honey, what's wrong, he would instinctively know that something was wrong, and then he would take it a step further and figure out what's wrong using his intuition, and then he would go and do something for her to alleviate the situation without ever verbalizing anything. And they do that. I mean, I've seen it. And it's really kind of amazing because it's second nature to a lot of them, especially to the women. When the two cultures clash, there's a problem because the intuitive side is more developed on their behalf, and the verbal or logical approach is more developed on our behalf. And it's like you're not communicating in the proper way to alleviate the situation. As a matter of fact, even though your intentions might be good, you inadvertently introduce more anxiety by the questions that you ask, simply because they're expecting an intuitive response and you're expecting a verbal response. It's really very strange. But the reason that I bring it up is because it's a good demonstration to the fact that culture has a lot to do with the way in which our intuitions are either developed or suppressed, and also the fact that some cultures obviously are more intuitive than others. Now, you want to take that a step further, go down to the eastern regions of Peru in South America and talk to shamans, people that actually practice being in their intuitive mind much more than being in their logical mind. And you talk about getting lost. I mean, these are people that basically go out into the jungles and solicit information from plants. And believe me, you don't do that by talking to the plants. You know, you do that on a higher level. And then, you know, they will actually ask the plants advice. I have a friend who's sick. You know, could you tell me what kind of plant has, you know, the curative properties that he needs to heal this difficulty? And he'll spend a day or so in the jungle, you know, conversing with these plants, and he'll actually come back with legitimate information and the proper herb.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so
now, in the United States, in certain parts of the United States, the method is shoot first and ask questions later.
Right, but that's not exactly intuitive.
No, it isn't. I'm just I'm pointing out that we don't even go to that level.
No,
and of course,
I realize that.
That's an extreme.
It's an extreme, but it's also in the exact opposite direction. You know what I mean?
Yes, absolutely.
And it's a shame in a way, it's kind of wondrous that our species can operate over such an incredible range of an incredible spectrum of behavior. But on the other hand, it's very unfortunate, at least in our society, that so much of it is down around the lower frequencies. And some of them probably even go below zero.
Yes, that's remarkable. Now, I wonder, does the man that goes out in the jungle know intuitively when he's gotten his answer, or does he have to wait for the plant to tell him to leave?
Well, I don't know how it works, and I'm not pretending to know because I don't have that sensitivity. But here's what I can do to answer that question. I can jump to the areas of development where I have some prowess. And I can probably give you some kind of an indication as to what he might experience. I know that if I'm trying to solve a problem in physics, And I'm working at it very diligently, but I'm also putting the problem out into the universe through my higher consciousness. And what I do is I use the logical part of my mind to assess and focus on what the problem actually is, and then I rely on the intuitive part of my mind to give me an answer. And what happens when I get results is I will see a flash. Sometimes it's an actual vision, like a, not a vision in the sense of some vista opening up, but like a flash of knowing that you perceive in your mind as a picture.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't last very long, but it's got the substance of the answer in it. And then with that comes the feeling of it's right. And when I feel that, I don't have to question anything. I know damn well that if I go and make that thing, it'll work. I trust it implicitly, Don. I've been doing this since I was, oh gosh, I don't know, preteen, anyway. So I definitely trust it. And I can only imagine that what the shaman experiences when he's attempting to glean information from these, from the vegetable kingdom is something along those lines. If he requests the information properly, and the plant kingdom responds, it will be with some kind of information and also a feeling of correctness. Otherwise, how could he do anything? You know, it's got to be those two things. It's got to be the information that answers his question and the affirmation that it's correct. And that's what I would assume is happening based on my own experiences. Now, it could be something much more than that, but I don't think it can be anything less than that.
Now, what these methods you're describing, what's going through my mind, and I guess this is for the listening audience out there that's wondering, okay, so suppose I do this. I gaze into the corner of the room where the two walls meet the ceiling, and I'm able to perceive this reality that Jim's talking about, or I talk to a plant, or I go out and hug a tree, or I do this experiment with the artificial sweetener or some other toxic substance that's been introduced to the food chain, either through restaurants or grocery stores. Then they say, what do I do after that? My answer would be that you would have experienced that sort of altered state or heightened state of consciousness, and things are going to, just by opening up that window or that door, that doorway to higher frequencies, you're going to seek that out again in other ways. And you might just intuit another way to express or to experience that same thing. Maybe that is the moment where you contemplate a solution to a problem and allow your creativity to flow. Do you want to comment on that, Jim?
Sure. As a matter of fact, I do, because what you're really describing without saying it, Don, is that by tinkering around with these trivial pursuits in the intuitive direction, once you start to get positive results, the most important thing that you're doing is actually two things. First of all, you're reawakening those centers by doing these simple little things. But more important than that, you are establishing trust. When you start to see the verifiable results, like checking the time or, doing the little experiments with the shreds of paper and asking questions of your higher self and things of that nature, when you start to see results that are coming and that they're correct most of the time, you will begin to establish trust in this facility. And then that changes your whole demeanor. And once you begin to do that, you're already opening up your consciousness. You can't trust in something you don't believe in. And as soon as you start to believe in it, it starts to work. That's the interesting thing about it. So even though they're baby steps, that's one way of starting out. I mean, I could probably give you a whole show directed upon how I try to solve problems, you know, toward the art of inventing things.
Mm-hmm.
But my concern with taking that approach, even though it's using the same facility, is that not everybody is necessarily going to be able to follow that simply because it's a method I've customized for myself. And there's a danger in doing that, you know, trying to teach somebody else exactly how you do a certain thing, because if they can't do it, it can have a greater negative effect upon them than if they struggle along and find whatever method is best for them. That's part of the problem with this whole thing. You can't objectify it very easily. Everybody's approach to their own higher consciousness is a subjective experience, and it may not even be in common with another person, but it can be oftentimes similar enough for them to be able to say, like me and Randy talking, for instance, oh, yeah, I know what you mean. I don't do it that way, but I know what you mean.
Yes. I think what you're describing, in a sense, too, is another aspect of what we call responsibility. Responsibility.
Right.
Taking our responsibility is not just this duty that we have, but it's being able to identify and relate to our higher powers. See, that's where that word power comes in now. Some people call them gifts or spiritual gifts. That's the one liberating quality in this whole mess that we're trying to undo is the fact that the spirit contains all the knowledge and all the power that one requires to move towards freedom.
Yes, and the interesting thing is it manifests in so many different ways, and that's one of the reasons why it's so difficult to do scientific work in this direction, is because everybody with these sensitivities finds a different way of expressing the same forces, and that does not appeal to the scientific mind, but too bad about that, because that's how the thing works. It's as varied as the number of individuals and personalities on the globe, and you just have to contend with that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are some individuals, for instance, that are born with an exceptionally high degree of the intuitive mind already in place, or else, if that's not the case, then perhaps they just haven't been subjected to any criticisms or negative influences to suppress, you know, their natural gifts in that direction. But
mm-hmm.
either way, I have seen things when I was a lot younger and more into this. I met people that could do amazing things. I remember being in a car traveling to Newark Airport in Jersey many, many years ago. And the radio was playing on the in the vehicle during the trip, and it was tuned to some station that was playing rock music. But there was a guy sitting in the back seat, and he suddenly blurted out and said, "Oh, quick, change it to WOR. Such and such a song is playing, and it's my favorite one." And everybody was blown away, but we changed the channel deliberately just to see if he was, you know, if there was anything to the remark. And it was actually exactly what he said. And the thing that was so amazing about it wasn't an isolated incident. He did it very often. Oh, he'd say, go to WNBC, this is playing, or go, you know, to some other station, such and such a song is playing. And, you know, there was a time when you'd be burned at the stake for that kind of thing. But it doesn't make any sense to have a negative reaction, because it's obviously a facility that we have at our disposal.
Yes.
It's just some people are more gifted in that direction than others. But we all have it to some degree.
I had an experience. It's funny you mentioned that. I had an experience a number of years ago. Actually, it was about 27 years ago. I had driven from Columbus, Ohio to Akron to pick up two comedians that were working at our comedy club, Red Fox and Slappy White. And they weren't going to fly from Akron to Columbus. It was too difficult to get a flight without waiting a whole extra day. Back then, they didn't have the frequency of flights that they have now. So I drove there. And coming back, we were in this stretch of the road where we weren't picking up the kind of music that they wanted to listen to on the radio. And I had a CB radio, and I turned it on, and we were listening to the chatter between these truck drivers. And it was pretty funny what we were hearing. And then one guy kept playing country music over his CB radio. He had his AM radio going, and he would play Tammy Wynette and Dolly Parton and all the, Hank Williams. And Red Fox said, why don't you see if you can tune in an R&B station and play some of your music back to him. And so I got on the mic in a break where this guy had stopped playing a song. And I took over the airwaves, and I announced that I was going to play a hit by Jose Feliciano, Light My Fire. And I swear to you, I turned up the volume on the radio, and it's the moment I hit the talk button on, and holding my microphone right by the radio speaker on the dashboard, over the airwaves came Light My Fire. And they were astounded. Now, I had no idea what was going to play. I didn't even give it a second thought. I just announced that was going to be the song I was going to play. And I had the same experience. So I know that that's true. And
well,
actually,
it's very much like speaking in tongues, you know. You get in a certain frame of mind, and the information just starts coming through your voice channel. As long as you trust it and you don't violate that connection, you can learn from that. Never mind amaze your friends, you can actually learn from it.
Now, I asked them after that song played, and I mean, they were just amazed. I said, any requests? Of course, they laughed. But it actually happened. That was about 27 years ago that happened, too. So I know that is very, very possible. I've done it myself. I don't know that I could do it with that accuracy or that frequency, but I certainly did it at that moment.
Right. And that's how a lot of this stuff is. It's totally spontaneous.
Yes.
And you have to get used to that.
Yes.
One thing I learned, Don, in my earlier years, I was exceptionally interested in telekinesis and the ability for the mind to influence matter directly.
Mm-hmm.
And so I read everything I could find on the subject and anything related to that, you know, for quite a few years. And I actually had some measurable results after a while, but they were very small. You know, I wasn't knocking bricks out of chimneys or anything. It was just like moving, you know, little compass points or something very, very delicately balanced. So the forces might have been minute. But what I did learn in the process of pursuing this information is that your tendency is to concentrate on the result that you want, and that will always defeat you. You
mm-hmm.
just have to know that it's going to happen and allow it to occur, which is a totally different thing. I mean, I don't know how to explain it any better than that, but it's the exact antithesis of concentration, as we are taught to do in the Western world. And many of these things work on that basis. You have to allow them to occur. You can't force them to occur with your mind.
Yes. Now, you know, in the beginning when you were talking about the physical aspects of this, and you were using the artificial sweetener as the example when I made the rat poison remark, because that's actually what it is, methods that science uses or the medical community, going back into, I'm going to say the 70s, it seemed to be sometime in the mid to the late 70s, they got into this thing of using biofeedback machines. If you you remember that area or that era.
Oh, absolutely. That's a very interesting approach. Yes, I'm familiar with it.
Well, we have this ability within us, is the point that I want to make, is that this is, we are natural biofeedback machines,
mm-hmm.
in the sense, or beings would be a better word. We are living beings that can actually make these measurements, feel them, or see them in some sense. There are people that see auras. There are people that hear sounds or feel the aura or feel the sound. And a perfect example is when you're standing in a line at a grocery store and you notice all of a sudden that maybe the person standing behind you is putting out this vibe that just gives you the creeps. You feel uncomfortable. You may even decide you want to change lines to move away from that energy. And so it's important to recognize where you're going with this, that you're always operating, we say in metaphysics, operating in the light. It's not that we're dabbling in the occult here. What it is we're facing and we're learning to recognize and understand who we really are, our true nature. There's nothing evil about how we were created. Now, we can have, it's quite possible that we have been modified in some aspect of our consciousness, or that we've had our consciousness totally cut off from our reality, from who we really are, and we've forgotten that aspect of our power. And so what you're saying is correct when you're describing that a person might get undesirable results. Your intention should always be to arrive at the truth, to see the highest good, so that you can benefit yourself and ultimately benefit others. Because we're all doing this together, really. We have been intentionally separated or at least forced to comply to certain rules, certain regulations, certain laws that serve only to disconnect us from our true self. So that's what I wanted to say there anyway, that your counsel in that area, not to produce fear. People can feel fear because they're delving into the unknown, but the methods that you're describing are pretty simple, pretty elementary.
Well, you got to start somewhere, but
yeah.
The problem is that, you know, there are certain things I know about that are beyond that, but here you run into a really steep problem, and it's not only one of credibility, it's one of, I don't know how to even express it, it's one of not being able to communicate it. Because if you haven't had a common experience about something, it's very difficult to convey information about it. You know, it would be like for me starting to get into a discussion with someone in the audience, for instance, about the work that I've been doing with gravitational forces and how that interacts with geometry.
Mm-hmm.
It's meaningless because they have no similar experience to give them any anchorage in that direction. And that's part of the problem with this higher stuff. If you don't have any common experience or common ground, it's very, very difficult to convey stuff that you do know. It's even difficult to verbalize some of it. And I was talking to Randy only last week about this, and he said, well, quite frankly, Jim, you can reach a level where you just can't express it in words anyway, no matter what you do. The only thing you can possibly do is try to guide somebody else to that level. And then he just said, oh, I know what you mean. And that's where it ends. Because you get to a point where you're beyond words, you're beyond descriptions, you're beyond, you know, the limits of physical reality, and you're way off into those regions normally reserved for the gods. And there's nothing in human experience to allow you to convey that. And that's part of the reason why, you know, some of these powerful mind-expanding drugs that, like ayahuasca, for instance, which is commonly used in Peru by the shamans, puts you in a state that is you are so transcendent above your normal everyday experiences that whatever happens to you there is yours and yours alone. When you come down from that, you can't even relate it to somebody else. And it's not like LSD or any of those cheaper things that just give you some kind of a bad trip. This is an approach that's thousands of years old and allows you to reach a level where I'm not so sure you come back with an understanding so much as you do a realization that there is an infinite amount of consciousness yet to be obtained. Mm-hmm. And that's in itself a very valuable and humbling experience. But it's not necessarily something you can share with the guys over a beer.
Yeah. I've come back from a near-death experience with something similar to what you're describing. It's an awareness and a realization of a higher state of being in a totally different reality, and you certainly see how where what freedom is, and you actually when you're told that you have to come back or it's in your destiny or that you've agreed to perform some task, let's say that you haven't. And you realize you haven't performed the task, but you're in such a state of bliss that it's very understandable. You don't want to leave that state, and yet we don't have to go to heaven to reach that level of consciousness. That's the whole point here, and that if we're going to uplift humanity and solve our problems and stop all the senseless wars and murdering and thievery and all the things that we do to each other, somehow with this misconception that we're going to outlast the other person, you know, we're going to escape death, or as long as it's the other guy, I don't have a problem with death. As long as it's the other person, I don't have a problem with starvation or poverty or whatever ills that befall mankind. We have to come to a realization individually that we have that power within us, and that we're not going to get the answers from that we really seek in that level from outside us. It's already inside of us. So we're just discussing tonight the methods through which one can tap into that. Prayer is another example of the same thing, but it's prayer not out of some destitute situation, not out of despair. Effective prayer is actually producing positive results it's a successful prayer is going to make the intended communication. It's going to have purpose in it, and all of the factors that are involved in the answering of that prayer are going to occur if it's done with integrity and it's done with the expectation that the prayer has already been answered.
Yeah, that's a very important factor right there. You have to, there's two things about prayer that are worth touching upon. You just touched on one of them. You have to pray with the realization that it's already been done, or at least the attitude that it's already been done. The other thing, which I think a lot of people get screwed up on, is reciting formula prayers, excuse me if I'm offending anyone, has no meaning in the scheme of things within the universe. You have to address God in the language that he responds to. And mumbling formulas over and over again isn't the best way to do that. Best way, and it's been proven through the centuries, is that you form a picture in your mind of what it is that you're trying to accomplish, and you accompany that with the proper emotional feelings. A prayer is really a two-stage rocket to God. One, the cargo is what is the intent, and the fuel is the proper feeling. And then you release that from your mind into the universe with the same attitude that you described, Don, the realization that it will actually be done for the good of someone or something. And if you do it properly, it will happen. That's how miracles are performed. That's how all these higher functions actually work.
Yes, actually, I came to the realization that what we call a miracle is actually a normal event in the universe. Down here, it's a different story. And I say down here in the sense of a frequency. We tend to think of the rest, you know, we think of heaven as somewhere up in the sky. It's right here, too. It's everywhere. It's just a matter of perceiving it or learning to perceive it. Remember where it's at, or just open that window or that door. Pull back the veil. There's all kinds of different ways to describe the process, but heaven has never left us. It's never separated itself from us, or God for that matter. We have, in some aspect of our being, allowed others to do that for us, or to us. And so we're talking about the realization and the acceptance that has occurred. If we're in denial about it, there's no point in even talking about it, is there?
No, not really. I mean, it's like anything else. You have to believe that what you're pursuing is real, or why would you invest the energy? Or even the interest.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But, you know, what we're really talking about here, Don, and I hope this doesn't offend anybody, but what we're really talking about is coming to the realization that we are God. Not the whole God, but some fragment of it. And therefore, depending on the size of that fragment within us, we have not only the ability, but the right to pursue these higher functions and make use of them. That's actually another one of the gifts that was given to us when we were bestowed with life. It goes along with the package. It's just a shame that the controlling forces, one of the first things they do in their program for dominance is to squash the magic out of your life. And magic, G-I-K, not M-A-G-I-C, is the realization that these higher powers represent your portion of divinity. And by teaching us that God is external to ourselves, we are effectively disarmed.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of the problem.
Yes, before we close here, I'd like to come back to this concept of the I that I sort of defined in a way. You know, I is the first letter in the word individual. And we're speaking about the whole individual. And when we talk about the thing that works, and we touched upon it again in prayer and then again in this definition that you just gave us, the imagination or the magic nation, the all of us, the singularity and its oneness with all life, all of creation, is really the key. Our ability to tap into our imagination, to dream, but to dream consciously with purpose and intent, and to pull ourselves out of the past, out of this, well, it was always done this way. We have to do it this way. This is how it's done. This is where we keep repeating the same patterns over and over. And if they worked for us before, we wouldn't need to correct them. It's quite obvious with the chaos that we have in the world, it's not working. Those methods aren't working because we haven't really addressed these issues as seriously as we have. Now, in the last two nights, we have my two guests, Michael Anthony, and you and I have discussed for 5 hours, we have discussed consciousness and individual responsibility, and we've discussed knowledge and various paths to get there. And hopefully this show, as well as last night's show, contains enough fuel and enough information there that you can embark upon this path and start doing something to answer that question that I got in hundreds and hundreds of emails. We're wondering, what can we do? People are thanking me, Jim, for the truth that's coming out through all the guests, you included. And they realize these things are going on, and they state things like they're busy getting food on the table, getting the kids washed and dressed and to school and going about all their duties, work and paying the bills, and by the time they're done, they're exhausted. These things are very empowering, are they not, the things that we're talking about, where people are feeling like they're lacking in energy and intestinal fortitude?
Yeah, absolutely, Don. Let me just get one more remark out, which is very important before you close, because I know we're gone over.
Yeah.
And that is that if you really tune into this stuff, even if you don't do it to the highest extent that we have described, but you do it with fervor and with the proper intent, you will find that the more you do in that state, the more empowered you are. And what I mean by that is, I've been doing this most of my adult life. If you approach life from this perspective rather than the normal, everyday, redundant and materialistic point of view, what happens is you somehow are given enough energy not only to accomplish the things that you need to do, but you have an abundance. I mean, I'll give you an example. Right now, I know darn well it's after 2 o'clock in the morning. I've been up since 6 yesterday, and I know that every time we have one of these discussions, by the time I hang up with you, I'm so supercharged that I have to turn on the TV and and do something or read a book or do something for at least an hour and a half, so I can wind down enough to sleep. And it's that kind of thing that we're talking about. You start to get into these higher realms and start to change your perspective of life, and you'll be rewarded in many different ways. One of them will be an abundance of energy, guaranteed.
Yes, I feel that same thing right now, and I do every week. Every night, really. Every single night. And now I did a show Monday night by myself. I did a two hour show on sort of leading up to this. I alluded to the fact that at least two nights this week were going to be spent on this. Actually, every guest all week in their own way contributed to this discussion in ways that we can empower ourselves. Now, what are people going to do tomorrow, Jim? What went through my mind while you were describing that? They're going to go about their business, and they may have this thought creep back into their consciousness. Well, that show last night, that was interesting. I heard some things I hadn't heard before, or I heard that before, and I wasn't really paying attention to that. I didn't have time to do this, or maybe I'll try that Monday. Or maybe sometime next week when I have a few minutes to sit down. That's fine if you do that. That's fine that at some point you begin this journey. What I would suggest, and I would do this with this how I preface the show tonight at the beginning, for those that join the show later on in the broadcast, I brought up the issue of solving a problem either by yourself or along with others in a spirit of an appreciation for how serious it is to solve that problem. If it meant the difference between are we going to be here alive tomorrow or are we going to destroy ourselves tomorrow, would you start on that right now or would you wait until a certain time tomorrow just to test to see if something happened? Because we're really in that state right now. Where every problem that we have, and think about your children. Think if you don't think about yourselves, think about the children on this planet. What are we leaving for them? How responsible have we been for them? Because they depend upon us as providers and teachers and role models and all the other aspects of what we can be to children in society? Or have we abandoned them? Because we could be struggling with our own realization that we have failed at so many things and yet we didn't need to fail. So this is how soon do you want to experience some modicum of success? And I don't mean success in the way man sees it. It's not about how much money you're able to make out of this, but just changing the reality of your life that we allow the earth to heal and we heal ourselves. We nurture ourselves or nourish ourselves, and by doing so, we nourish our minds and we make that connection with our higher selves, our soul, the higher aspects of our being and the rest of the universe. There's a lot to that. How long would you wait for that to happen? Certainly, Jim and I are not waiting for that to happen by having this discussion tonight. I'm sure you would agree with me, Jim, that's part of our roles here in being alive is to bring this awareness to people. And to invite them into these discussions and to think about this and to begin applying this. Because as we all do that, we can change what we have. There'll be some that will turn on the TV and maybe not just as a distraction or a way to wind down, but they have to know what's going on. And so they're going to go right back into the box. They're going to go right back into the matrix. And and maybe even forget what they heard tonight. Maybe say, oh, this sounds like too much work. It's much easier just to let things go the way they're going and never realize the joy of really being alive and really being responsible and creative and actually manifesting their dreams that they've been told their whole life is an impossibility. Even though they, in one sense, they've been encouraged to dream, they've not been shown how to dream. They've been not taught the mechanics of dreaming and thinking and feeling and listening and seeing in the true sense of all of those words.
Yeah, I agree with you, Don. As a matter of fact, you know, when the situation finally gets to the point where you are as anxious to do these metaphysical things as you would normally be to watch a football game or, you know, buy a new suit or whatever turns you on, that's when you know you're really making progress. You have to really want it. And you have to pursue it with a passion. You know, just if you remember back to your really early days of childhood and learning, the things that turned you on, the things that you were attracted to with all of your being and all of your interest and all of your energy, almost to the point where your parents had to restrain you from pursuing them, it's that kind of dedication, interest, and purpose that you need to approach this stuff with. If you don't, then you'll wind up putting it on the shelf until that day when you have time. And let me tell you something, it never comes.
Yes. You know, it doesn't matter who is going to be the next president of the United States. That person is not going to bring these solutions forward. And the solutions that have been promised to us have been promised for hundreds of years. And we still don't have those. Those promises have not been fulfilled. We're at a state right now where they're totally ignored. All the dignity of our national constitution has been flushed down the drain, and we're living without the rule of law, other than these laws are rammed down our throats while those that create them are above them, and we're experiencing wars and senseless murder of millions of people nonstop. Our country, the United States of America, has never experienced one day without a war going on in its total existence. It's continuously had a war. Yet how many times have we heard this phrase, this is the war to end all wars? Of course, until we realize that we should have never said that. We just said that because it sounded good. And we heard it, and it sounded good to us. So we put our attention in other places, on the false self, and on our fears. And we raised another generation on those beliefs and compounded it with more problems instead of solving them. And it's really simple. The solutions to fixing all of these things come down to us recognizing who we are as individuals. And if we are fragmented, if we see ourselves in our own appraisal of ourselves, not what someone else says about us, but how we see and feel about ourselves, if we are fragmented, then we have a responsibility to ourselves to remember who we are. And make a choice about who we are or who we will be and start being that person by doing, by taking action and applying this. And it won't be long before we can begin to talk to each other and communicate to each other and listen to each other and arrive at solutions. It'll happen very quickly that way, not as fragmented, divided individuals that really aren't even aware of their true nature and their true power, their true abilities.
Well, that's right, Don. And you know what's interesting, too? All those things you just described are actually functions of consciousness. You don't have to go into all these meditative states and do all these metaphysical exercises. You just have to be conscious of what's really happening. You mentioned something that was really worthwhile, that we've been promised the same garbage for 100 years and nothing ever happens. There has never been one president, and I'm pretty darn sure I'm saying this correctly, there has never been one president that has ever fulfilled his campaign promises. And I'm sure this new guy will be no exception. Why is it that fact doesn't register? It's because, there's an obstruction of consciousness. If people really understood that this is the case, they would begin to question the system. That's an expansion of consciousness. Not that you hear the same drivel every time somebody gets elected, and then when it doesn't happen, you just say, oh, well, I guess that's the way it goes.
Yes. Well, Jim, we are out of time. We did go over quite a bit, so... but it was enjoyable and very informative and a good exercise. And like you said, I feel energized. And so I look forward to your next visit a week from today on the 14th. And I thank you for all the time that you spent.
Well, it's no problem. I feel energized too, and I hope that the audience does.
Yeah, they didn't interrupt the show tonight. They've been writing in saying that if they don't call in, it doesn't mean that they're not enjoying the show. They're hearing the truth and they've chosen not to interrupt the flow. So I did that a few times, but but with good reason. So
well, maybe they'll be kind enough to give an appraisal after the fact.
Oh yeah, I'm sure I'll get some mail over the weekend. You listeners out there that like to email, let us know what you think, and we'll get people to call in next week, I'm sure. So
very
Jim,
good,
you have a great weekend and a great night. Don't stay up all night now.
No, I won't. And
okay.
Same to you, my friend. We'll talk to you soon.
All right, thank you. Folks, you have been listening to Evident Footprints on bbsradio.com and our special guest, Jim Murray. Jim will be back next Friday, as usual, and we'll have another interesting topic to discuss. And by all means, try this out. Go dive in head first and see what you come up with. Of course, I have mentioned several times that... I feel that if you consider listening with your heart and even some thinking with your heart, listen as you get quiet and do some deep breathing and relaxing and allow yourself just to feel what's out there, you'll find that you can let go of this attachment to the ego, it's been created as a mind heart, as I perceive it. It's a false way of feeling, and your real feelings come through the heart center. Try that out, and just try a few of these things. Certainly download the archive. Listen to it again. It bears listening. I learned 10 times... What I've experienced being part of the interview, just listening to it myself after the fact. And I know that if it benefits me that way, that you are likely to get something out. And certainly, tell your friends about the show and share this information with them. That's why we give it to you. It's meant to be shared. I want to thank Don Newsom for making Evident Footprints possible, Seth Hendrick on the sound, and most of all, the listening audience for tuning into the show. I wish everyone a night filled with peace, love, and light, and have a good night.